Great, thank you. And thank you very much for having me out to talk here. Sorry it took me so long to get here. I had several canceled flights, but I'm here now. You know, maybe I'll have flights canceled and I'll be here for even longer. Right, so let's just dive right in. Here's something that you have possibly heard at this point, which is that the standard model Higgs potential is unstable. So what do we mean by that? Well, we mean that if you calculate the running of the Higgs-Quartic coupling in the standard model, so assuming just the standard model, you find that the Quartic coupling runs negative at some scale, at scales above some instability scale lambda I. So here's just a plot of the Higgs potential, normalized in terms of actually the position where the potential is maximized. I could totally get used to this. And you can see that sort of just past where the potential is maximized, the coupling turns over and the potential runs negative. And so what is the instability scale? Well, within two sigma bounds on the measured values of the Higgs mass and the top mass, you find that the instability scale is around 10 to the 9 to 10 to the 16 GeV, with the central value being somewhere closer to 10 to the 11 GeV. So this has been talked a lot about. So what are the implications of this instability? Well, one thing that people have studied extensively is the idea that our universe is metastable. And so what we mean by that is, you know, we are living in the electroweak vacuum. But if there is this instability in this runaway direction, that means there is a true vacuum that we could nucleate to. And so that means that the electroweak vacuum can decay via Coleman-DeLucia instanton. However, calculations demonstrate that the lifetime for this decay process is in excess of the lifetime of the universe. And so this is a paper from, this is a plot which is possibly a little too small from this paper about investigating the near criticality of the Higgs boson. And you can see that within sort of the 1, 2, and 3 sigma contours that they use, we are solidly in this metastability region, which is where the lifetime of the vacuum exceeds the lifetime of the universe. So this is very interesting. It's been studied a lot. But aside from sort of being, you know, an interesting observation, it doesn't really have any phenomenological implications for, you know, physics beyond the standard model. Like, you know, you'd hope that we'd do this calculation and we'd find that the universe is horribly unstable, and so we know there must be new physics out there in order that couples to the Higgs to stabilize the Higgs potential. But that's not the case. You know, metastability is completely consistent with the observation of our universe, and so we don't necessarily need new physics or anything like that to stabilize the potential. So, interesting, but sure.
Sorry, just a random question, but I mean, for the purpose of these calculations, is it assumed that the potential eventually turns around to become positive again, or do they just worry about tunneling to the place where it becomes negative root of the standard model value, and they don't worry about whether or not it becomes positive?
So it's a good question. They do not actually put in anything to stabilize the potential. And that's because the tunneling rate, so the tunneling rate is dominated by the release point. So in other words, the side of the potential where you escape. And so you don't need to nucleate all the way to the true vacuum. So the answer is these calculations just assume the standard model. They don't put in anything to turn around the potential or to give a second minimum, and you don't need it to do the calculation. However, one sort of interesting fact is it turns out that there's been work on this more recently because it turns out that the release point on the potential is coincidentally very close to the Planck scale. And so that's interesting because obviously this is where you get a significant contribution to your tunneling action from. And so there's been some recent work by Mark Scher and collaborators where they look at how if you add sort of order one Planck suppressed operators, this can actually drastically affect the metastability. So perhaps it's not fair to say the phenomenological implications of metastability today are limited because, you know, there are these analyses that suggest sort of exactly because of this issue you're bringing up, which is, you know, what is the value of the Higgs field inside the bubble, that the actual lifetime could be very different. But that, of course, requires putting in something about high-scale physics and not just the standard model. So. Right, so limited phenomenological implications today if you're just considering the standard model. But what about during inflation? The reason that this is interesting is because, you know, for the most part, if you have, you know, your small Higgs potential, then we know that light scalar fields acquire quantum fluctuations into sitter space that are on the order of h on 2 pi, where h is the Hubble scale during inflation. And so that means that if your Hubble scale is at all comparable to your instability scale, then you expect these quantum fluctuations to mean to result in fluctuations in the Higgs field such that it samples the unstable vacuum. And you know, so you could talk about, so as opposed to just talking about metastability today, you could say, well, if we underwent a period of inflation, in particular high scale inflation, might we be more worried about the instability and the potential? And this is a lot of people started thinking about this, particularly in the aftermath of the BICEP2 claim that they'd seen primordial gravitational B modes, and so the scalar to tensor ratio was around 0.1, because that would mean a relatively high Hubble scale on the order of 10 to the 14 GeV, which, you know, is larger than the, you know, going back to this plot, you know, 10 to the 14 GeV, which lies along this line, is larger than the instability scale in much of the preferred parameter space for the M Higgs M top values. And so there's been a variety of work on this, but to know whether or not we care about this instability during inflation, we have to study the evolution of the Higgs field, and we have to understand, you know, yes, the Higgs field can sample this unstable region, but what are the implications for our universe? What exactly does this mean? How does it work out? And so this is the question that I started with some collaborators about a year and a half ago, trying to answer, you know, once again, unsurprisingly, slightly before BICEP2 came out, but unsurprisingly, we were kicked into gear by the BICEP measurement. And we discovered something very quickly, which is that this is a very difficult problem. So for those of you who work with light scalar fields in de Sitter space all the time, I'm sure that you see someone put up that this is a difficult problem and you say, really? I think about, you know, fluctuations of a light scalar field in de Sitter space constantly. You know, there's plenty of study of this sort of phenomenon. People talk about, for example, the axion field picking up fluctuations and isocurvature bounds. But there's even a canonical textbook example of this, which is just your usual slow roll inflation model. So if you take your inflaton field, your slow rolling inflaton field, and you decompose it in terms of a homogeneous background value and local fluctuations, then effectively the conditions of slow roll on the potential imply that the fluctuations are effectively massless. And so you can go through and you can calculate what is the characteristic size of the fluctuations what is the characteristic size of these light fluctuations? You find that they grow as sort of h on 2 pi, and then these local fluctuations produce local, where here when I'm saying local, I'm meaning, you know, on the order of what we can think about observing, so on the order of a Hubble volume during inflation. But they produce local inhomogeneities in the energy density and hence in the local curvature. This leads to local inhomogeneities in the temperature spectrum of the CMB. And so, you know, this is well characterized, and it's, you know, the seeds of structure formation coming from exactly these light inflaton fluctuations. So a similar story should hold for the Higgs fluctuations. Like I said, this is, you know, a light field. It acquires some fluctuations, And then in the same way that we had local variations in energy density due to local fluctuations in the inflaton field, we also have local variations in energy density and in the Higgs-Bev due to the Higgs fluctuations. And so note when I'm talking about like the value of a field in a patch or the VEV in a patch, what you want to be thinking about is you want to be thinking about the sum over all of the super horizon modes. Because if you think about being in a patch, then sort of all the modes that are longer wavelength than the horizon are effectively what add up to give you what the constant background value looks like in that patch. So in the same, so if we have, you know, local fluctuations in the Higgs field, we can get different values of the VEV in different patches. And, you know, then we can talk about sort of what is the Higgs VEV in a patch? Has the Higgs in a patch transitioned to the unstable regime or not? So given that there is this background of studying light scalar fields in fluctuation, light scalar field fluctuations during inflation, you might ask, well, like, really? Like, so why are you telling me the Higgs is a difficult case? So the Higgs is a difficult case for several reasons. The first is that the Higgs is not really exclusively a light field. So yes, it sees the de Sitter expansion, this leads to fluctuations, but the other thing is it has this potential, this unstable potential that we're interested in. And the potential becomes relevant once the motion due to the potential becomes larger than the h on 2 pi fluctuations the Higgs is experiencing. So we have not only the Higgs spreading out due to its usual, due to the usual fluctuations in de Sitters, or sorry, the Higgs field distribution spreading out not only due to the usual fluctuations in de Sitter space, but we also have this potential that is in principle driving it to diverge more, you know, this unstable potential that's driving it to diverge more rapidly. So we have to take into account the potential. The second thing is we have to ask, you know, how does the behavior of the Higgs field affect inflation? How does it affect the universe? And the reason this is relevant is because in the unstable potential, there is a runaway direction. So once the Higgs field starts, you know, once the Higgs field starts running away, we expect there to be a very large negative energy density in the Higgs field. And this energy density, so there are a couple of things. First of all, now we have a situation where we have, you know, patches that are running away and are in what we would call the true vacuum. But, and so you might think that you have a normal story. You have nucleation of true vacuum patches, and so that could destroy the universe, for example, or at least destroy all the patches of electric vacuum. But while we're inflating, we have causally disconnected regions of space. So just because I am in this unstable vacuum in one place doesn't mean that that should be communicated to any other patch during inflation. The second thing is if we have a very large negative energy density in the Higgs field, this can in principle cancel against the energy density in the inflaton field. And so there's this, you know, even if we did have true vacuum patches, eventually we sort of expect these true vacuum patches to become so unstable that they have this huge negative energy density and you get a conversion to an ADS-like space as opposed to the inflationary de Sitter space. And so these patches can rapidly turn around and crunch and evolve to a singularity. And so there's this question of, well, if I have this picture of causally disconnected patches and some are in the unstable regime and some are in the electroweak regime and some are unstable but still expanding and others are unstable and they've started to crunch, then that creates a very messy space-time. It's not just like having, you know, a light scale, you know, a light inflaton fluctuation in what is otherwise a relatively homogeneous background. So sure.
Maybe you're going to get to this, but to get back to the question we were discussing a moment ago, in this background, when you're asking the question of what happens when the Higgs transitions during inflation into the true vacuum, does this part of the story matter, or does this part of the story depend on whether or not the potential actually turns back around, or can you do it by just knowing where the crossover point is?
So it turns out that actually I'll go through what I think the correct way to study this problem is. For the case I'm considering of like high scale inflation, this doesn't really look like your standard tunneling calculation. And the reason, and so you can sort of think about this as, you know, totally, like you can just think about this as like a, you know, almost a quantum mechanics problem where you have some potential, and then you have, like you have something living in a potential, and then you have an energy scale which is just like whopping huge compared to that potential, right? And so instead of thinking about it as something that is mostly held in place by a potential and occasionally tunnels out, you actually need to adopt a different formalism that takes into account basically that this field is like, that really is opposed to just having, you know, a distribution that's localized one place and then localized another place. You have a like coherently spreading out wave function.
But it doesn't matter whether or not you actually know what the true minimum is.
No, so I would say that actually the distribution that you get does very much matter on what, on like the overall distribution that you get for the field does very much matter, depend on what the true potential would be. In the case, so I'm of course talking about just like the instability in the Higgs field, and so, sorry, in the standard model Higgs. And so in that case, I'm not really considering anything to kick into gear until I get up to the Planck scale. And commensurate with this question about large negative energy density, once the Higgs field is at sort of, and I'll once again touch on this a little bit more, but once it's at the geometric mean of the Hubble scale at inflation and Planck, which we expect to be sort of significantly below the scale, that's when like these back reaction questions become important. So yes, in principle, it does matter, but you know, from the perspective of just considering the standard model Higgs and gravity, higher dimension operators shouldn't be relevant unless they came with like ludicrously large coefficients that I have no reason to understand. So, but yeah, it's a good question. And so the final thing is, the importance of the Higgs is that it couples to other standard model particles. And so this means that, you know, there are the usual complications associated with a full model. First of all, we have the evolution of the potential and the coupling with scale that I talked about. And second of all, there are gauge invariance issues. So, you know, it's, if I have like a complete Higgs multiplet and I have, then I, what potential am I talking about? Am I talking about the effective potential, which is, you know, how you get these calculations of the turnover? The effective potential is a gauge-dependent quantity. And so, you know, it's been discussed by these authors that you have to be very careful when you try to extract physical information from calculations based on, for example, the effective potential. So, sort of actually getting exactly to how to do this calculation that you were asking about, Gordon. So here's like a case study in like why this is confusing. So one way that you would normally think you would do a calculation for field tunneling in a de Sitter background is using a standard instanton calculation. And in particular, the relevant instanton for sort of larger values of the Hubble constant is the Hawking-Moss instanton. So what happens in the case of the Hawking-Moss instanton is this, the Hawking-Moss instanton is basically an instantaneous transition of the field from the minimum of its potential to, or the local minimum of its potential to the top of the barrier separating it from the true minimum. And subsequently from that point, you assume that the field rolls down to the true minimum. And so you can calculate a transition probability, which has some unknown prefactor, and then has this exponential form, where delta V is the potential height difference between the maximum of the potential and the whatever your local minimum was. And so this is a calculation that is used frequently for transitions from unstable vacua in like in the presence of large curvature, it's a reasonable calculation to do because it's gauge invariant. You know, you get this exponential form by evaluating an action on a solution to the equations of motion. It's also gauged in gives it a physical interpretation. It's also gauge invariant because it only depends on the potential evaluated at stationary points of the potential. So this might be sort of exactly the right calculation that you think you want to do. The problem with this calculation is sort of so what, right? Like, so what if I have a patch that during inflation transitions to the top, like transitions from the bottom of the minimum to the top of a barrier? Like, during inflation, first of all, like, that patch can still be dominated, that patch's behavior can still completely be dominated by the inflaton for a long time, even as the Higgs starts to roll away. Once the Higgs value does get very large, and then we are truly in like a back reacting phase in the true vacuum, then if that patch does crunch and during inflation, like I said, causally disconnected patches should be free to evolve independently. So even if that patch does crunch and produce like some crazy defect, like a black hole, you know, inflation is exactly designed to dilute away things like that. It solves our monopole problem, right? And another thing is, if you imagine that like right at the, suppose you say, okay, well, not during inflation, so it's right at the end of inflation, it transitions to the top of the barrier. Well, there's still an energy density that still is causing, you know, the expansion of the universe at the end of inflation. And moreover, as you have reheating and you are generating like a radiation-dominated universe, these thermal effects could happily stabilize this patch. Even if it looked like it had gone over the barrier, I generate a large thermal mass for the Higgs, and maybe the field rolls back down to the minimum. So it's not clear why this calculation gives us the information that we need to truly understand what's going on with the Higgs during inflation. And the other thing is, many people have tried to apply this to this case of the Hubble scale being like way, way larger than the instability scale, which translates to this h to the 4 being significantly larger than the height of the barrier. And then you know, people say, okay, well, so then the exponential goes to, like, the exponential goes to 1, so you have a really high tunneling probability, and, you know, like, where, what does that imply for H? Well, that means that H needs to be much smaller, H to the fourth needs to be much smaller than this delta V. But then what they do is they take this probability and they say, well, has a single patch transitioned? Okay, so I'm gonna raise that to the number of patches, e to the 3n, e to the 180, right? And then you tell me I don't care about the unknown prefactor, like e to the 180? Like, that could be, you know, 9 to as many decimal places as you can conceptualize. And still you could have had a patch that's gone over to, you know, the top of the barrier. So it's, many people use this approach, but it's unclear that this approach does at all what you need it to do. So the important point is we need to study the full evolution and distribution of Higgs-Webb fluctuations during inflation. And so I'm gonna, this is the lofty goal of this work and this talk. And so what I'm gonna do is I'm going to break it down into steps so that we can try to build through it. So first, I'm going to talk about a toy model of a quartically interacting scalar in a Gaussian approximation that has an unstable potential. And I want to see how this unstable potential affects the fluctuations of the universe, the fluctuations of the field, and consider what the possible implications are for the universe. Then I'm going to go to a more traditional, so in the Gaussian approximation, everything is dominated by the two-point correlation function, right? That's what the Gaussian approximation means. So then I'm going to go to a more traditional perturbative calculation of the correlation function and try to use this to connect to what we did in the first toy model, and also see if it gives us some hint as to how to incorporate the standard model. And then finally, I'm going to move to another stochastic approach, like the Hartree-Fock approximation, called the Fokker-Planck equation, which incorporates non-Gaussianity and gives us information about like the pathologies that are occurring due to the instability. And hopefully this will provide us some information about what we think is relevant for the universe. And, you know, like I said, I think this is a difficult problem. We've broken it down into steps because we think it's a difficult problem. So, and I think it's also a really interesting one. So people should feel free to ask questions throughout. And, you know, I'm always happy to think more about any of the subtleties here. So I am running quite behind time, so let's get moving. So first of all, the cortically coupled scalar. Like I said, the goals for this section are we want to study how the fluctuations are going to evolve in an unstable potential and consider the implications for the resulting universe. So, sure.
I mean, you may have said this earlier, given that I came in late in the talk. Do you assume that there is a term that couples like h squared times r?
No, thank you. I should have mentioned that. I'm gonna take the Higgs to be a light minimally coupled scalar.
Okay.
So I'm not, yeah, if I added operators like that, that would, you know, depending on what the sign of it is, that could either more stabilize or more destabilize the potential. I'm just going to consider the minimal. But yeah, thank you. That's a good question. The other point is if I had higher dimension operators that coupled to like the inflaton energy density, for example, that's huge. So that could in principle stabilize or destabilize me as well.
So you're just considering lambda h to the fourth, where lambda is what it is at the high scale.
Yeah, lambda. I'm gonna right now just take lambda to be negative. The purpose of section two is it's gonna reveal what we think lambda should be.
Okay.
So let's start with the equation of motion for a field in De Sitter space. We're gonna take, as I said, a cortically coupled scalar with an unstable potential. And then we're gonna study the fluctuation. So I'm gonna decompose the field into a homogeneous background value, which I'm gonna take to be zero on the grounds that this is a homogeneous background that could give rise to our universe, right? We're starting in the electroweak vacuum. And then I'm gonna see if the fluctuations do anything. If I imagine displacing the background value, that's, you know, in an unstable potential, that's just gonna make things worse. So I'm being optimistic. I have, you know, in the same way that people talk about the initial conditions problem for inflation, I now have two initial conditions problems, but I also have an unstable potential problem. So we're gonna just work on the unstable potential problem. And so what I can do is I can decompose into local fluctuations and then decompose those local fluctuations into modes and derive a mode equation. And in doing so, from the V prime term, the lambda, which is gonna look like lambda H cubed, I get two momentum integrals left over, and those are gonna combine to give me this correlation function. So the thing is, remember that the value in the patch is made up of the Higgs value plus the fluctuation, right? So if I started with like a large value that was on the right side of the potential, then sort of the fluctuation doesn't have to go so far to get over the unstable value, right?
So it does not make
your problem better. And then there's the question of also the homogeneous, like in this case, for this simple example, the homogeneous background value evolves as well, right? So then you can have the question of like, does my homogeneous background value start rolling away? And then, you know, then I have further to go and I'm getting closer to where I don't want to be. Or is at this point, it's sort of sitting on the, you know, top of a slope. So what is this two-point function? This two-point function is showing up in this equation can be taken to be the super horizon fluctuation two-point correlation function. So what that means is this comes from, like I said, these leftover momentum integrals, which are...
There is going to be some slow roll of the Higgs, right, during the process. I mean, it's masses during that time, and you're assuming that the potential of the Higgs is not dominating the energy density, I would imagine, right?
Right.
So you're saying basically taking a background lambda h to the fourth to zero by hand.
Yeah.
And you're saying that's a good assumption?
I'm saying that's sort of the most conservative assumption, right?
It
like
will just make
this,
it worse.
Yeah, right. So it's like, in the same way that people say during inflation, you know, I want to get like chaotic inflation giving my universe. So I need to have like I need to consider a patch where the field value starts at exactly the right multiple of M Planck. Like that is the same initial value problem here. Like I want to get my universe. So therefore I'm assuming that there is some initial patch over which it is a good approximation that the Higgs value is zero.
So So you're asking the question, what is the minimum requirement
right.
to get stability?
Right. So things could be way worse. But I would like to know, like, do I necessarily, like, could I just have gotten
lucky? If you start from the center, you will slow it up, right? Because the heat effectively is inflating in some sense during that time.
Well, but I mean, if I start right at the center of the potential, then, you know, by symmetry reasons, by symmetry, the only thing that happens is the fluctuations, right? Like, it still sits at zero, but then...
Yeah, but then classically it won't move because the... Continue.
Yeah, so the classical value doesn't roll, and it's the quantum fluctuations which encode all the dynamics. So this is the correlation function that I want to consider. So there's two things to note about. First of all, I'm considering it only to be taken over superhorizon modes. So when I've done this, I've thrown away the subhorizon mode contributions. That's actually not a problem because I can cancel. Those are all high energy local physics. So to study the superhorizon modes, I can cancel those off with local counterterms. And so in doing so, the dominant effects of the subhorizon physics on the superhorizon physics is going to be reabsorbed into renormalization. That'll become clearer in section two. So this momentum integral is cut off at for only the superhorizon modes. And the second thing is it also has an IR cutoff. This IR cutoff corresponds to the region of space over which, you know, my homogeneous background value is a good approximation. So I'm going to take that to be a co-moving box of size of the horizon at the beginning of inflation. And all that means is that all of the modes with lower momenta that were superhorizon at the onset of inflation, these are just what we're setting that homogeneous background value of zero. Looking at this object, I can take this mode equation that I had, I can multiply through by a mode, I can perform this integral, and I get this equation for the correlation function. So I have a term due to the potential. The other thing I have is I have a stochastic noise term, which comes from the time dependence of the horizon crossing. So in other words, from the upper limit of the integral. And this equation permits a solution, which I can just write down. It looks like this. And so this is exactly what we need to sort of talk about how the fluctuations are evolving in an unstable background. Specifically, you can see that the unstable potential is accelerating the growth of fluctuations relative to the usual h on 2 pi growth I talked about for a massless field. So that's totally reasonable, right? The instability is driving my field to diverge more rapidly. But in fact, one interesting thing is it causes the correlation function to diverge in finite time. So there is a maximum value of this number of e folds, n equals ht, at which point this tangent function diverges. And so in other words, my fluctuations get just, at some finite time, my fluctuations just start running away and getting completely massive. Okay, so we've answered the first question, what happens? The unstable potential causes the fluctuations to get large, but what is the relevance? So as we've, sure.
Should I interpret the divergence in that statement to mean that linear theory breaks down?
Yes, certainly. So I've been working in two things. So first of all, I've been working in a slow roll approximation. Second of all, I've been assuming that this quantity is smaller than h such that my modes are effectively massless and so that I am in a linear theory. However, because of the way that the tangent function behaves, these conditions aren't violated until like really very late in the game. So until you get to n's very close to n max. And at that point, things are like blowing out of control anyway. So yeah, this is not a robust number in the sense that my approximations are breaking down, but they're not breaking down very far before this. So yeah, it's a good point. And we'll reappear in a couple slides. So as talked about, you know, one issue is once my fluctuations become large, I can get back reaction, I can find patches evolve to a singularity. And in fact, this doesn't really even require that my patch gets all the way out to this geometric mean. It happens pretty soon after a patch leaves the slow roll regime. So what does this mean in terms of this divergence we found in the correlation function? Well, in the Gaussian approximation, the typical size of a fluctuation is determined by the variance. So fluctuations this large, you know, are many, many sigma away from most of inflation. They're many, many sigma away until the variance starts to diverge. And so that means that even if I do have such a rare fluctuation during inflation, I expect that if I get a huge fluctuation in a patch and that patch crunches and it creates some sort of defect, then this is a rare defect and it's going to be inflated away. And this is true until this variance starts getting very large. Now, once this variance starts getting very large, basically I've got huge fluctuations all over the place. And that means that at any period, I expect patches to be transitioning over to where they're quickly crunching and back reacting sort of at any second. So this means two things. First of all, it means that if I did manage to end inflation at this point, I'd expect to have tons of crunching, tons of patches that crunch right at the end of inflation and a huge amount of defects and inhomogeneities in my universe at the end of inflation, which is bad. We've observed very small inhomogeneities in our universe, and so there's no reason that I should exit inflation with a ton of defects of the sort that inflation's supposed to get rid of. Moreover, it might even be the case that if I'm producing like tons and tons of, you know, if I'm producing order one crunching patches in any phase, you know, people have done analyses of what this looks like in the case of internal inflation, where, you know, I have a huge number of crunching patches being produced in each e-fold of inflation, and they find that topologically this space is actually unstable. Your inflating patches can't percolate, they can't inflate enough, and in fact the entire space may collapse to a singularity. So it's clear that once n starts, within this Hartree-Fock approximation, once I start reaching this divergence of my correlations, it's very unlikely that I'm going to get a universe that looks like ours. You know, it's either going to have huge inhomogeneities or I'm not going to get a universe at all. So within the context of the Hartree-Fock approximation, what we can say is we can say, okay, we really think that this n max is a bound on the number of e-folds of inflation. So inflation, high-scale inflation, could produce our universe as long as it doesn't go on for too long and the fluctuations don't get to be too big. So that's the toy model. So now let's move on and, well, first actually let's make a few comments. So first of all, what I've talked about is we think necessary for our universe, but it is not sufficient. Because obviously if at the end of inflation I have an unstable patch and it's in the true vacuum but it's not crunching, then if this patch, you know, if this patch comes back into causal contact with other patches, it is basically a bubble of true vacuum. And so it could nucleate and destroy the regions of the false vacuum region, electroweak vacuum. So I think I have a condition for surviving inflation, exiting inflation. That does not mean that I necessarily get the universe. There could still be conditions on like the stabilization of these patches by reheating. The next one, which I've touched on, is, you know, there, as Gordon, in response to your question, there was, you know, I assume masslessness, I assume slow roll, I didn't regulate this, you know, assumedly unphysical divergence. Maybe I should be throwing away back reacting patches or those that are exiting slow roll. Fortunately, none of this becomes relevant till I'm so close to n max that I don't expect them to change the story. So my approximations are only breaking down at the point where everything's becoming pathological anyway. One bigger one, though, is I treated the field as a Gaussian stochastic variable. Non-Gaussianity, we expect to be relevant in these regions of large fluctuation because that's where self-interactions of the field should become most important. So given that, it is possible that the non-Gaussianity can greatly affect what I think the true inflationary scenario is. And so that's going to be the point of section 3, and returning to that. And finally, as mentioned, I took there to be a constant quartic, and that's exactly what hopefully section 2 is going to reveal, whether that's valid and what that constant quartic should be. So let's move on to this correlation function in the context of perturbation theory. So what we want to understand here is we want to understand how the stochastic approach we just looked at connects to a more traditional perturbative calculation, and to elucidate how to extend this simple toy model to the case of, to incorporate like the rest of the standard model particles. So what does the perturbative calculation look like to next to leading order? Well, you have to calculate a bunch of diagrams. So, and the diagrams will be separated into two points. There are these scalar-only diagrams, which are what generate these leading, what we call leading IR logs, which are these logs that are leading to the divergence of the correlation function. And then there are the rest of the standard model diagrams, which contribute only to the sub-leading IR logs. So the first step in this calculation is I consider just sort of scalar propagation in a de Sitter background. So I take the first diagram, I calculate it in the coincident limit, so where I'm considering the separation between these, you know, I want to consider the fluctuations at a Hubble volume size point. So I take the coincident limit, by which I mean that these two points are separated by less than a Hubble volume, and I find the usual IR behavior for a light scalar field. So that's what you would want to get, you know, in terms of keeping the leading logs at least, the leading IR logs. And so that's what you would want to get out of, you know, the perturbative calculation, and that is completely consistent with the way we understand that light scalars behave. So the next thing to do is to move on to the next diagram. So let's go on to this one loop diagram. This one loop diagram is proportional to the contribution of this scalar loop up here, which you can plug in the mode equations for a light wave, for a light scalar, and you find the expression on the right. And the expression on the right contains two important types of terms. First of all, it contains terms I'm going to classify as UV, which are this quadratic divergence and a log divergence. And these are exactly the same divergences as you'd encounter doing this loop calculation in Minkowski space. As you expect, these are very high energy modes. To them, physics looks completely local. The only difference here is, as opposed to getting logs of lambda over an energy scale, here my energy scale is h, so I get logs of lambda over h, and these are exactly the terms, these sub-horizon terms, are exactly the terms I said could be canceled by local counterterms, so I choose my local counterterms to only study the super-horizon dynamics, I cancel these off, and then I choose a scale mu, you know, this introduces a renormalization scale, and I choose a scale mu equals h to resum the logs. So that's usual perturbation theory. The difference here, the really interesting difference, is these IR logs, which is if I look here, I have this log of the scale factor over the scale factor at the onset of inflation. And that is exactly what gives me growth in the correlator with the number of e-folds. So the big question is, if this is the important IR log that is causing my correlator to diverge, then where do these all-important IR logarithms come from? Well, the point is that the scalar wave function is not suppressed outside the horizon, right? This is, your scalar modes freeze out outside the horizon, so they take some constant value, and so that means that they can still contribute to the correlation function. And so as a result, if you do this calculation, you find that you get a second order term, which is growing even more rapidly with the number of e-folds. And so this means several things. First of all, for lambda less than zero, as promised, this is causing the correlator to diverge. Second of all, it means perturbation theory, in the same way that we saw the breakdown of the, you know, linear approximation, perturbation theory here is breaking down once you get to some large n, that's signaled by this term becoming dominant relative to that term. And so we see from the perturbative calculation the same sort of divergent behavior. Moreover, if we expand our Hartree-Fock approximation, we get something which exactly matches the perturbative calculation. And so this addresses our first question. What was the Hartree-Fock approximation doing? Well, the Hartree-Fock approximation was resumming these leading IR logarithms that are contributing to the divergence of the correlator. So that means that what we should take out, that means that not only do they incorporate this one loop diagram, but they are in principle also incorporating all the higher loop diagrams. And this analysis has been done for demonstration. It's been done you know, in a more formal way in the context of toy models with just a scalar by a variety of authors. Okay, so now we sort of understand from a perturbation theory standpoint what exactly was going on in the Hartree-Fock approximation. The second question, though, is now that we extend the perturbative calculation to a more realistic, you know, the standard model, is that going to tell us how to incorporate these additional diagrams? Well, as I told you, the leading IR logs are coming from the fact that the scalar is unsuppressed outside the horizon. But transverse gauge bosons and fermions are damped outside the horizon, so they do not directly contribute to the leading IR logs. The leading contributions are calculated only including scalar loops. So that means that the toy model that I considered should be the bulk of the calculation. But it's not the entire calculation, because while the standard model particles don't directly contribute, the high energy superhorizon modes do still give the normal flat space-time result. And so they do what they do in Minkowski space, which is they generate logarithms of the form of the renormalization scale over the energy scale. And as a result, what they effectively do is they renormalize the coupling all the way down to the scale mu around h, where their effects decouple. So this tells us that if we want to be studying the Higgs with an unstable potential, we can use the toy model, and we can use the model with just the scalars, but the subtlety is we need to choose lambda correctly. And if we want to keep our perturbation theory under control, the right answer is that we need to use lambda to be the RG-improved standard model quartic at mu equals h. And so this is a pleasing result from the perspective of these concerns about gauge invariance, because now we don't need to do this calculation in an effective potential where the field values are gauge variant. We just use our usual result, and we plug in the renormalization group and proof coupling constant. And that also tells us that considering, you know, if H is larger than the instability scale, then considering a case where the quartic coupling is negative, you know, just constantly at some particular value, is going to be a good approximation for studying. So because it's getting late and I'm sure people want to know physically, I'm going to skip over a subtlety that I'm happy to talk about what about the Goldstone bosons and how do those play into the story. The quick summary here is it just means that actually, you know, if you correctly incorporate them, the real Hartree-Fock limit lies somewhere in between these two values. But so let's go on to the Fokker-Planck approach. So the Fokker-Planck approach calculates a probability distribution to observe a particular fluctuation in a patch. So if the Gaussian approximation were valid, like if I had only a Gaussian field, then P would end up to just be a Gaussian distribution with variance set by that two-point correlation function that we were looking at in the Hartree-Fock approximation. And then I could calculate all other, well, and I can always calculate correlation functions by that. And so the lessons that we've learned from 1 and 2 is that a stochastic approach like this, if we use just the tree-level potential with the RG-improved quartic coupling, should capture the leading IR-divergent behavior in the correlators and in the fluctuations in which we are interested. And so we're now going to apply this philosophy to study sort of phenomenologically what's actually going to happen.
Can I ask a very dumb question? So,
sure.
I mean, the problem of Higgs by himself is very old. Mm-hmm. So what would people use it for the quartic before?
So you mean instead of this?
Yeah.
So there were two things. First of all, people were plugging in the full effective potential, and they were solving the Fokker-Planck equation with the full effective potential.
Okay.
So that's one thing. And so that has these issues of gauge invariance.
Yes.
And it also sort of does the problem twice, right? Like already you're resumming the perturbation theory logs.
So, yeah.
So that's one thing. The other thing is many approaches just do Hawking-Moss. And like I said, they encounter this problem of they're like, oh, there must be new physics because the probability of any single patch transitioning is gigantic. And it's like, well, so,
yeah.
You know? And the third thing is actually this approach was taken by Espinosa, Giudice, and Riotto.
Yeah.
But they employed a weird boundary condition, which is that they said, okay, well, the field just rolls away to infinity once it's over the potential barrier. So I'm just going to set the probability distribution to be zero at the maximum.
So, but you don't sit there.
Yeah. So once delta A is, so I'm going to solve this equation subject to the boundary condition that the probability distribution for all values greater than the maximum is zero. And so this is motivated by the idea that I reach the maximum, I run away quickly, that patch disappears from my space.
Yeah.
But like I said, that unfortunately doesn't seem to give the right result, at least in my understanding, because that patch can still inflate. You know, it still has a background energy density. And in fact, enforcing that boundary condition, you know, as you can expect, sort of like anchoring your probability distribution too early pulls down the probabilities a huge amount.
Yeah.
So these were the approaches that were employed that we were trying to fix up in this. And so that's great that you asked that question, because that'll allow me to skip over a slide in a second.
Okay.
So a quick aside, what is lambda h? Well, it runs down. It tends to reach this approximately conformal regime. For the central values, you find that it's in those regions. So when those numbers pop up in later slides, don't be massively surprised. But so what does the Fokker-Planck equation tell us? Well, it tells us that, you know, basically, as mentioned, once you're out at large field values, the non-Gaussianities resulting from the quartic coupling start to become important. And so as a result, these regions don't just spread out like they are spreading out coherently. They actually start to run away very quickly. And so that means two things. First of all, it means that the most pathological patches have sort of interesting behavior that wasn't captured by the Gaussian approximation that we need to look into. That's the importance of using Fokker-Planck. The second thing it means is that, like previously, we were just looking at when this quantity diverged to get an idea of when inhomogeneities get large. But now, a divergence of that could just be caused by the divergence of some really rare, crazy patch. It doesn't mean that there are large inhomogeneities necessarily. So we need to consider other ways to interpret what comes out of the Fokker-Planck. So this is what was done previously. What was done previously is that by Espinosa, Gio, Dicci, and Riotto, is they considered the proportion of patches that survive in the electroweak vacuum at the end of inflation. And they say, you know, is this proportion consistent with, like, inflation lasting long enough to give the required number of electroweak patches, assuming that all other patches just disappear quickly? As mentioned, though, they suffered from this problem where they enforced this boundary condition that yanks down probability distributions. So in some work with some collaborators, we attempted to fix this, and we found that if you don't impose this boundary condition, then you're fine. You can always just inflate long enough to replace all your lost patches. But the assumption that these patches just, you know, crunch benignly as soon as you're over the, like, that this is the quantity you care about doesn't really make any sense. Because as mentioned, these patches don't crunch rapidly. In fact, they don't crunch rapidly until they are until they blast past the slow roll regime. So that's one thing. The second thing is that patches that are crunching benignly at the end of inflation aren't necessarily, even if they are crunching quickly, they're not necessarily benign, right? Like if I'm producing a ton of primordial black holes right at the end of inflation, then, you know, I don't necessarily look at a universe that's consistent with having a ton of primordial black holes at the end of inflation. So the assumption that we adopted in our second work is we said, okay, let's assume that the patches that crunch at the end of inflation are always, any patches exiting slow roll always crunch rapidly. These patches can't be stabilized. You know, they turn into defects really quickly. And so then you can say what proportion of surviving space is becoming unstable at any e fold of inflation by calculating how many patches you are losing to outside of the slow roll regime relative to the number of patches that were surviving at that point. And then you can say even if the unstable patches, i.e. those that are over the maximum of the barrier, but they haven't quite exited slow roll or stabilized, what is the minimum level of inhomogeneity? And you find that, you know, you're sort of fine for a while, and then eventually you spread out, and these pathological tails start running away really quickly. And so you start reaching non-negligible levels of inhomogeneity really quickly. And so these are some values that come out of the Fokker-Planck equation as to when you reach a certain level of inhomogeneity. And these are relative to what you would say the Hartree-Fock bound on inflation was. So you can see that it creates quite a different picture of what the universe might look like. One way you would have said, okay, you know, I have some upper bound on inflation. But in this other picture, you say, well, it actually really depends on these pathological patches. Because either they're running away so quickly and they're just getting sloughed off during inflation that, you know, this situation never really occurs, or I'm reaching a point where I'm producing such large defects so quickly that, you know, that the universe is like, that the instability is incompatible with the universe already. And so, you know, if our universe does, and so the way that that is phrased is you can say if our universe does require that the inhomogeneities are below a certain level, then we have to have fewer E folds than are necessary to reach that level of inhomogeneity. And so this is analogous to saying, oh, we have really large inhomogeneities in the Hartree-Fock picture when we reach N max. So for example, you know, I talked about this idea where space becomes dominated by, you know, like space becomes dominated by crunching patches, and, you know, then the entire space as a whole becomes, like inflation terminates, space as a whole crunches, we never get a universe. Well, you can see here that these do tend to asymptote, and they do not asymptote to an order one value. So consistent with the results I was talking about, where we have enough surviving patches and you can always inflate long enough, it does not appear that we ever reach a situation where so many patches are becoming rubbish that it completely defeats inflation. However, we can also see that you get inhomogeneities pretty quickly. Like, so if only a really small value of inhomogeneities is tolerable, then the existence of our universe is very likely inconsistent with the instability. So for example, if these crunching patches lead light primordial, light rapidly evaporating primordial black holes, and there have been arguments that light rapidly evaporating primordial black holes lead Planck mass relics, then actually these relics could, you could get so many of them that they overclose the universe, especially because they would redshift like matter as opposed to radiation. And then you need like a really tiny value of inhomogeneities. And so the instability would completely rule out our universe.
What stabilizes this thing? Why are they relics?
The Planck mass relics.
Why are they relics? Yes. What is the quantum number that stabilizes them?
This is admittedly only in so assuming there is some large large charge and angular momentum for the black hole.
There doesn't have to be
certainly, and so you know. It sort of depends on what exactly is the nature of the defects caused by these crunching spaces, you know, because once again, they're caused by the crunching with some, you know, field with gauge numbers, you know. We're trying to work out what the, pardon?
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, I mean, that is an open question. So getting to the open questions, so is the instability in the Higgs potential fatal for high-scale inflation? Well, sort of the big lesson that I took out of this is, you know, transitions to the unstable regime don't seem to mean what people thought they meant during inflation. There's, you know, you can still be over the barrier and inflate for a significant period. You might have really unstable patches that crunch, but that doesn't affect the causally disconnected other patches, and you know, inflation should dilute away any existing defects. Like we said, that's one of the things inflation does. And as you never get like a gigantically huge proportion of crunching patches, it doesn't seem that your space ever becomes dominated by crunching space and collapses. So inflation can proceed, potentially producing our universe. However, the other key point is that at the end of this instability is regenerating all the defects and all the nastiness and all the inhomogeneities that inflation was supposed to be flattening out. And so the really important question is not necessarily what does the instability imply for inflation that people have been asking, but the question of what does it imply for after inflation? What does it imply for the post-inflationary scenario? One thing it implies is you probably do have unstable patches. And as patches come back into causal contact with the expansion of the horizon, this is a usual, you know, domain walls separating true and electroweak vacuum, and, you know, these patches potentially, these domain walls moving and patches, you know, true vacuum potentially nucleating. So they're really, so these patches do likely need to be stabilized. And so this does imply certain things about the reheating scenario and the post-inflationary evolution. And then there is this question of what exactly are these defects? Assumedly, they're primordial black holes, but are they stable primordial black holes? Do they leave Planck mass relics? If they leave Planck mass relics, then this is, you know, aside from people going, ooh, primordial black holes is dark matter, you know, like, if we get exactly the right number, if we don't get exactly the right number, then there really need to be very few of them, and these defects are completely disastrous for producing a universe that looks like ours. So as mentioned, it does not seem to abort inflation, but it does likely generate defects that are not necessarily inconsistent with ours. And so unfortunately, the summary I can give you is not, we have answered this question fully, but the instability is not necessarily incompatible with our universe. And in particular, it's not necessarily incompatible with an inflationary stage producing our universe. Now, there are lots of open questions about what happens at the end of inflation, what happens with reheating, what happens with dynamics, you know, what exactly do you need, like how quickly do you need reheating to happen so that you can stabilize patches, you know, and I can imagine some crazy numerical simulations where I'm considering, you know, unstable patches that are rolling away and starting to crunch, but I'm also having, you know, expansion of the horizon, and so I'm having movement of domain walls, you know, very, very complicated stuff. That I think is open and really needs to be answered to, you know, question, you know, what exactly this instability implies for cosmological history. But the once again, the takeaway is it does not, like, just because you get large fluctuations in the Higgs field during inflation, that does not, that based on this analysis, that does not mean that the instability is completely incompatible with high scale inflation. And so sorry that I think I, yeah, sorry for running 10 minutes over, but thank you very much for your patience. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I'm around to tomorrow. And like I said, I think this is a fascinating topic. I'd love to talk about it more and learn more about it. And so, yeah, thank you very much for your time.
Assume that we're living in a scenario where interesting things are happening in the last default of inflation. You are getting some relics, perhaps, and that there's something complicated going on in bubble dynamics, right, as you're exiting inflation. But in the end, things work out in a universe that looks like ours. During that last default, or shortly thereafter, you're satisfying all of your Sakharov conditions, right? So could you take advantage of this to generate a variance?
You know, I had not given that thought. So let's see. I mean, I think that you, yeah, you know, it's a really interesting question. You know, you obviously get very quickly tangled up in model, you know, model dependence of how exactly is inflation turning off. You know, how are these things happening? And I don't, you know, I mean, one of the problems is, so, you know, a statement which is obvious to you, but this doesn't look like normal electroweak baryogenesis in the sense that, like, in my true vacuum, I've assumedly got, like, I guess I have really suppressed, you know, so I'm not buying anything in terms of, like sphalerons here, right? Because I've got like very large Higgs values and, you know, my domain wall, you know, I've got less suppressed and very suppressed on my two sides of my domain. And, you know, there's a question of these complicated dynamics like, and like the last E-fold, you know, an E-fold is a fair amount, you know, it's still dilution. Yeah, it's interesting. We should think about it and talk about it.
I'm not an expert in the inflation part, because that's what most on gravity. But I want to connect to the beginning of the talk. You said that just for the standard model, just for our universe, instability seems to not a problem because the lifetime is much bigger than the lifetime of the universe. And the end of the talk where you talk about sort of the effect of these crunching patches, which are defects and probably chromatic black holes. And that's exactly what we are studying and published the paper today, that we're showing that existence of primordial black holes together with this unstable potential, Higgs exponential, with some high dimensional operators, also adding.
Are you working with Ian Moss on this?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
providing sort of that the lifetime will be much smaller than the lifetime of the universe.
Yeah.
And this is what is sort of our first result on a sort of so-called pinballs, when you have to add these operators. But what we're now doing, actually, we're assuming that if you calculate the full numerical problem with the gravity, etc., you can get rid of this the coefficient of these operators with tends to zero, and the lifetime will still be much, much smaller than the lifetime of the universe. So the presence of the unstable Higgs plus primordial black holes is not possible. So this kind of tricky thing that you're saying that defects are producing such primordial black holes, we're saying that if they're produced, then we'll kind of survive.
So it's interesting though, because I've seen the stuff you guys work on. I think it's a really interesting idea. So for people who haven't been following this, phrased in a very phenomenological way, which I think is in your paper, is the idea is that bubble nucleation is like a fluid dynamics problem, and black holes can act as the nuclei that seed bubble nucleation. The one thing that I would say about the primordial black holes we're talking about is we're talking about like estimates suggest like mass gram. Pardon?
How much is it?
Like a mass of a gram. Things that disappear instantaneously. And so that's why there are no robust, so when people talk about primordial black holes, there are tons of limits based on the decay limit about like, do they destroy BBN? Do they produce, too much entropy? Do they produce too many gamma rays? What do their decays do basically? Same as for any late heavy decaying object. And the problem here is these things are like so small and decay so quickly that the only bounds that exist that I've found depend very heavily on whether you assume that they produce Planck mass relics or not, because otherwise they just contribute to reheating and they're gone. So like, I don't know if they, it'd be an interesting question. I can't remember the timescales you guys are talking about for nucleation. So it would be interesting to know whether these things necessarily live long enough to act as those seeds or whether they disappear before.
Yeah, I'm not sure about this except the ground.
Yeah.
But I can also note that black holes produce a smaller effect. We're assuming that any other defects, which are not black holes, or some just flotation in density, will produce a much larger effects. So other defects will be.
So we're talking about like delta rho on rho of.
Anything which can mimic some bump in the density will produce effect bigger than a similar black hole.
Yeah, I guess the only thing that's worth noting is maybe we should talk about this offline so that not.
Yeah, just.
Yeah, I have a thought on that, but I'll, if you don't mind hanging around after, I'll tell you what it is.
Thanks, Chuck.